Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Quick sound check reminder, the British pop band Squeeze bridged the gap between guitar pop and post-punk during the late 1970s and early 80s. Today on Soundcheck, Squeeze songwriter Chris Difford talks about reuniting one of Britpop's most influential groups. That's coming up at 2 on 93.9 FM WNYC. Now think about that shiny new building that went up in your neighborhood in, say, the last 4 years. You know, the one with all the glass and the exposed steel, the one you love or hate or love to hate. Of course, each one of you is probably thinking of a different building in a different neighborhood. Well, add all those up and you get a lot of shiny new buildings with a lot of glass. It's hard to get your head around it all, but that's just what New York Magazine critic Justin Davidson tried to do when he did a building-by-building survey of the most recent building boom. The result is an assessment of 54 different buildings, each with a side-by-side before and after picture of what was there and what is there. His article is called The Glass Stampede, and we have posted that slideshow of the before and after pictures that we're going to talk about on our website. You can go to WNYC.org and click on Brian Lehrer Show. You'll see the link to the slideshow right there, which has six buildings that we're going to focus on. Hey, Justin.
Hello.
Thanks for doing this. And just before we get to the specific buildings and give people a little time to go to the slideshow, confirm this for me. It is not just our imagination that every new building has that same sort of look, the glass, the steel, the shine?
Well, there's a lot of new glass and a lot of new steel, but there's also a lot of other kinds of buildings. And actually, one of the things that's been interesting to see is the variety of facades and treatments that we're getting, all in a context in which glass is sort of the ultimate modern material. And it's interesting to see that happen when it's not really a new material, but it is being treated at in some interesting ways and also in some very uninteresting ways.
And we'll look at some of these specific interesting and uninteresting examples. But is technology driving this? Are aesthetics driving this?
I think that one of the things that's happening is that architecture in New York is being driven by what was until now a very hot condo market. And so it's really residential architecture that's pushing it. And what we've gotten in and also as these buildings are going higher, views are really important. And the glamour of the wraparound view becomes an attribute of wealth. And so I think a lot of these buildings are designed for people on the inside of them to look out from. You've really gotten a whole residential architecture that comes from the modernist office building of the 50s and 60s combined with these individual houses in California, you know, from the modernist period, these sort of James Bond-like perches on the sides of cliffs where you could look out over all of L.A. or something. And what's really interesting is the way that idea of the view is being adapted to a very intimate city where, of course, if you can look out, then you can also look in.
And New Yorkers have always been a little nosy. So do we have even less privacy as a result?
Well, one of the interesting things about the way glass has been used is this idea of what is exhibitionistic and how much privacy you really get. It gets used as a metaphor for transparency. Often you hear architects, especially in public or office buildings, talking about transparency. That came up with Renzo Piano's building for the New York Times. The Times should be transparent in the same way that it seeks transparency in government.
So we definitely want the new AIG building to be all glass. All right, we can get away from that. Let's go to some of the specific buildings that we want to discuss. If you're on the website, take a look, folks, at slide one, the Avalon Bowery Place at 22 East 1st Street. This is between the Bowery and 2nd Avenue, just north of Houston Street. Describe this building and why are we starting here?
We're starting there because it's where I started my tour of New York, trying to get a handle on two conflicting senses I had. One was that there were a lot of very bad buildings going up, and I think this is a good example of a bad building. And the other side, which is a more generalized sense that actually New York has improved throughout this building boom in very tangible ways. And it was hard for me to reconcile. And this seemed like a good place to start because I felt like if I could figure out for myself why this building, as much as I dislike it, is actually not ruining New York, I would sort of understand these two conflicting things. It's very out of place. It's huge. What we don't see in the left-hand slide is a small four-story building known as McGurk's Suicide Hall from the 1880s, which was a brothel so named because many of the women working there had a reputation for taking the
We know what happens in a brothel. Yeah. And that's a brick building? It's a red brick building? Or it was?
Yeah. This is actually what we're seeing in the left-hand slide is a different brick building. But that's the vernacular of the area. So here we have a glass building, which is part of a much larger Avalon Bay development, which crosses Houston Street. In fact, it started with Avalon Christie Place.
And I don't think these photos are to scale. I think the new glass building is twice as tall as the other one, or at least it's eight stories compared to four, right?
Yeah. It's much, much bigger, and it also extends the whole block, so it swallowed up a number of smaller buildings.
And so did you come to some kind of peace about this? Because you said, you know, you were trying to work through your original revulsion and try to figure out why it may be good there.
Well, that building, as bad as it is, tries to do some things about the urban fabric of New York. One of them is that on the Houston Street side is Liz Christie Garden, which was a community garden, which rather than being simply obliterated by this new development, was actually sort of incorporated into it. The developers helped pay for some of the restoration of the garden. And on the other side is this little alleyway called Extra Place, which in some way the developers are trying to incorporate into the project and give it some life rather than just leave it the way it is, which is kind of a vacant alleyway. So, you know, what I found is that even insensitive projects necessarily have to grapple with where they are. And what I came to was a sense that a good criterion for figuring out how successful a new glass building is in New York is to try to understand how well it deals with what's immediately around it, and in a way, even more important, what was there before. And this does not do a good job of recalling or encoding anything of what was there before. It pretty much obliterates that.
Let's go to our next image. So again, if you're on the site, this is going to be image 2 of 6, and it is the new 42nd Street Studios, rehearsal studios right in Times Square, which I imagine in and of itself is a big challenge for any architect.
Yeah, I mean, to me, I know there's a lot of controversy about this, although it may be abating. To me, Times Square is a really big success story of urban renewal. I have fairly little nostalgia for the way Times Square used to be. This to me is a good example. It's a small building. It's a building where the program really relates to the revitalization of Times Square. It's a rehearsal space for dancers and shows. And it uses glass in a very spectacular way. First of all, you want to be able to see in and see out because it makes the performance part of what's going on, the performance of the street. It's very animated. It uses light in a way that only glass can. That's perfectly appropriate to Times Square. And it has this thin column of light, this little pole right next to it, which kind of sends light up into the sky. And so it doesn't overwhelm, but it really animates an area very gracefully.
And we're going to go on to the next one. At least on my computer, that image 2 did not load. All the other slides are there, so I don't know if some of the others of you playing along at home are having that problem. But let's go right on to the third example, image 3, if you're on the site. This is the Upper West Side, the Lyric at 94th and Broadway. You call this building eminently adequate, but also say in your New York Magazine article that it's one of the best things to have happened to the neighborhood. How so?
Well, specifically the renovation of Symphony Space is one of the best things to have happened because that's an invaluable really civic space for performances and community events and so on. And it could so easily have gone the way of various movie theaters and other theaters in Times Square and just disappeared. And the fact that it was not only saved but rejuvenated very artfully by Polshek Partnership and integrated into this building, I think is quite wonderful. The building, the larger residential building, is not wonderful, but it's fine. And it's by Kostas Kondylis, who's an architect who has sprinkled the city with residential buildings. He probably has had more impact on the fabric of New York than almost any other architect, even though he's less famous, because he does so many of these condo buildings.
So you can have a pretty ugly building as long as it's serving an adequate public purpose?
Well, this building is... does what it needs to do in terms of scale. It's really that's really defined by zoning. It has a certain amount of Art Deco detail, which is
nice.
It really does do a good job of orienting the views towards the river, towards the west. We're seeing the east side of the building on the slide, which faces Broadway, and of incorporating retail in the base. And of course, you know, that's controlled by zoning. One of the problems with these buildings is that every time you put up a new building, what the developer really wants in the retail segment is a good credit history. And that means...
And nobody has that anymore.
Yeah, but it was always very hard for mom-and-pop stores to have that. So they're going to go with, you know, banks and Starbucks.
All right. So moving on to image 4 of the New York Magazine Glass Stampede before and after building survey. We're going to head down the west side to 176 Perry Street, not that far from where we're sitting, in fact, here in here on Varick Street. And I guess that this is the – I guess you'd call this the Far West Village, right at the Hudson River. These are from Richard Meyer, and you say that they launched an era of glass-walled designer condos.
Yeah, I mean, these were incredibly influential buildings. They were controversial because if you can see from the photograph, it really raised the profile of the West Side, literally, in the Village, you know, where you had the neighborhood meeting West Street and the river with very low-rise buildings. This kind of creates the beginnings of a wall. And so many preservationists especially found that objectionable. And of course, because they're luxury buildings, they changed the whole character of that neighborhood by really bringing in different kinds of traffic.
And of course, one of the perennial concerns when we talk about this kind of thing is the issue of scale and zoning. So can I even ask the question, what does it do to a neighborhood to put up an 80-story glass building where nothing else is over 20 stories? Or is the answer really different on a case-by-case basis?
It really is different. I mean, you know, it really depends on the neighborhood. And I think sometimes you get some surprising effects if you go back up to where the Lyric is, a few blocks farther up. There are two thin towers that face each other across Broadway were hated when they were first proposed. In fact, they started going up even before anybody realized that's what was going up on those sites. And they were as of right. There was nothing that people could do to stop them. Now that they're up and they're much taller than anything immediately adjacent, I think they've actually been absorbed into the neighborhood quite easily. And they had contradictory effects. On the one hand, they raised the skyline right there in this kind of abrupt, spiky way. On the other, because there was this outcry, there was pressure to change the zoning, and they have now become, you know, choked off the possibility in that area for any more towers. So the effects are sometimes unpredictable, but I think the main thing is you have to think of views in New York the way you think of your health. It's great as long as you've got it, but it's not necessarily going to be there forever.
Yvonne in Brooklyn has a question about glass buildings. Yvonne, you're on WNYC with Justin Davidson, New York Magazine's architecture critic. Hello.
Hello. Good morning, and thank you for taking my call. I was wondering about the safety in terms of a lot of the new building going up near the sea, like in Williamsburg, and hurricanes. I know that's not an immediate thing, but I assume the buildings will be around for a while, and what the long-term safety is. Is that something thought about?
Yeah. Do they use glass in New Orleans and Galveston?
Well, glass has all kinds of there are many different aspects of safety that New York buildings have to address, especially in public buildings. There's one of security. And security, you kind of have to weigh different aspects of safety off against each other. I'm not an expert in the zoning code and how it deals with safety, but it is interesting to see that visibility in public buildings is an aspect of safety. And even though it may be less resistant to certain pressures, it does create other positive aspects of security.
How much is the use of glass less about aesthetics or modernity and actually more about cost?
Well, I think it's mostly about return on investment. I think that it's seen as as something that's saleable in a condo market. I think, you know, people come into an apartment when a broker is showing them around. The first thing they do is head for the windows and look for the views.
People like it. Because I've also read that while glass panels can get expensive, they're also less expensive as far as, you know, field work goes, less intense in that way, and cheaper than some hand-laid brick or natural stone or elaborate terracotta or those other other kinds of surfaces.
You know, glass, like everything else, comes in all different varieties and all different treatments. I think, you know, glass is just a material, and it can be treated in a debased way or a very refined way. One of the things I think that's happening is that as more and more glass buildings are going up, especially at the upper end, there's been a lot more research into how to treat it in interesting ways and in ways that give it some texture and some life and not just kind of a flat glare, but actually something that adds to the texture of the city.
New York Magazine's architecture critic, Justin Davidson, my guest on WNYC. His article, The Glass Stampede, about New York's see-through city, and his review of how much we're better off having this see-through city than the old one that had a lot less glass in it. And we're looking at six examples from his article that we've put together in a slideshow at WNYC.org. Click on Brian Lehrer Show. And we're on to slide five now. This is 497 Greenwich Street, even closer to where we are right now than the last one. This is a few blocks west of here, 497 Greenwich, and this has got to be the height of glassification. It looks to me like, I don't know, these windows, they almost look like flaps, some of them, that you could pull up and down. What are we looking at here?
This is a facade of a building by Vinca Dubbeldam. It's a fairly small condo building, and it wraps itself around an older masonry building. To me, this is one of the most successful uses of glass to treat what's a masonry block in a masonry neighborhood. And I say that.
And again, if you're on the site, the two slides in each of these cases are before and after. So that's what it looked like before, and this is what it looks like now on the right. Go ahead.
I mean, to me, this is a good example of what I was just saying a minute ago about glass acquiring texture and not just being this sort of flat, reflective, hard surface. This has a kind of liquid aspect. It almost looks, when you're seeing it, and it's kind of tinted a bluish green, so that it almost looks like it's cascading down the facade, like there's something liquid about it. But in another sense, it's got this kind of texture. It's almost tactile in the way that masonry does.
I'm glad you brought that up, because this I was really struck this summer when I had the good fortune to take the Chicago River architecture boat tour. And so much of the new architecture in Chicago is also glass. But I was really struck by how many different colors were reflected out there. It wasn't just all clear glass. It looked like there was blue and there was green and there was black. And I guess that's part of what you're talking about. Not all glass buildings look the same.
No, I mean, there have been a lot of advances in terms of coating, different degrees of reflectivity. You know, I think we've gotten beyond the period of these, you know, what I call the state trooper shades buildings, which just kind of reflect in this forbidding way everything back there, almost these mirrored buildings, to where you get glass that can also change in appearance over the course of the day in different lights. Sometimes that's because there are little protruding metallic elements that you don't even really see as separate things, but they add a kind of glint or shimmer to the facade of a building.
We've got 2 minutes left. Do you think that any one neighborhood has benefited the most from this building boom?
Well, the building boom is happening all across the city, and they're not all glass buildings, but the glass building phenomenon has kind of been part of this sweep of building across the city.
And certainly almost nobody in a neighborhood seems to like it when the buildings go up.
Yeah, but, most neighborhoods have improved, especially the ones that were most impoverished, even where the quality of the building that's going up may not necessarily be at the highest level. But, it's part of the – when you lower crime and raise property values, part of what you do is create incentives for building.
And is any one person behind this? Is there a Robert Moses of the building boom or the glass boom? Is it Deputy Mayor Dan Doctoroff?
No, this is really happening in a fine old tradition of New York lot-by-lot development. If it were master planned, it would probably be a disaster.
Let's get this one more slide in here. Slide 6, image number 6. And this is Porter House in Chelsea, right at 15th Street and 9th Avenue, which in a way seems like a perfect marriage of old and new. The glass is a little more subtly inlaid here.
Yeah. New York does not have a great tradition of adaptive reuse, which means taking an old building and finding new ways to deal with it or growing on top of it. A lot of other cities do, especially in Europe. We tend to kind of knock things down and put up something new. And this, to me, is a great example of taking an old building, repurposing it, respecting its original profile by setting back the new addition away from the street and complementing it in a way that's very creative, very respectful, and modern.
So 15 seconds left. What do you think about our new home here, 160 Varick Street?
It's certainly much nicer than the old one, much more comfortable.
Certainly the old one is beautiful from the outside.
Yes.
The old municipal building.
Yeah. No, I mean, it's a great building, but awkward.
And we are delighted to be here at 160 Varick Street and delighted to have Justin Davidson, architecture critic for New York Magazine, in to talk about his article, The Glass Stampede. And, of course, we'll leave that slideshow up on the site at WNYC.org. Click on Brian Lehrer Show. Really fun, really interesting. Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC.